This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
And a very good afternoon to you. Today, keen to get your thoughts on the Nationals formally scrapping net zero. This follows an internal review that concluded a net zero commitment no longer serves the interests of the Australian people. And it's just too expensive if we continue on this path. What do you make of that? You think the Nationals are onto something here or they're way off track? Let me know on the text 0448 922 604. Also today, just after the news headlines at 12:30 and then off to the Bureau of Meteorology, then we'll have a talk about the Bureau's new website because some changes have been made, especially to the radar, the colour of the radar, and some more changes on the way also. So we'll get into that, what changes have been made and what changes are still to come on the Bureau's new website. 12:06 here on the Country Hour. The future of meat processing in Northern Australia has looked pretty dire for a while now, but things could be changing, and in a big way. The $55 million sale of Yida Pastoral Company and its subsidiaries, including the Kimberley Meat Company near Broome in WA, is now complete. And the Darwin abattoir called Livingston Beef, which has been closed since 2018, could be sold in a matter of weeks. David Williams is Managing Director of Kidder Williams and last year was engaged by the Australian Agricultural Company to find a buyer for its Livingston beef facility. He thinks northern producers will have two meat processing options as soon as next year.
Well, I mean, I think it's been a fairly dire prediction for the future of meat processing in the top end until probably only this week because the Kimberley Meat Company was purchased but not settled with the Canadian Super Fund and was shut. And Livingston has been shut for many years. That's the one out of Darwin owned by Aussie Ag. So it's a pretty dire situation for top-end meat producers as to where they take their cattle for slaughter, and especially if the federal government has its way and bans the live trade in a couple of years. The alternatives at the moment are things like to take the cattle south to Gingin, which is 2,000 kilometres plus. I think what's happened, Jess, in the last week's pretty interesting because the Canadians have now settled KMC south of Broome, and I understand they've got people on the ground now ready to open that again, but more particularly to expand it, because it's quite a small abattoir, to expand it. And so I imagine that that will be fully operational sometime in the second half of calendar year 26. So that's great news for top-end meat producers. I think Livingston itself, which is currently on the market and being sold by Kidder Williams, my guess is that that will be sold and will be sold in the next few weeks and therefore also be open in calendar year 26. So that will give, you know, North End cattle producers, whether they're up in the Kimberley or whether they're closer to Darwin, you know, two clear alternatives for having their meat processed.
What impact could these plants reopening or changing hands have for northern cattle producers on the ground, do you think?
Well, I think that one of the problems, if they're not open, is where do you take your animals? And now, let's just put the live trade aside. That's possible at the moment. But to take animals south, especially thousands of kilometres, is, number one, very costly, and number two, ethically just a bit tough because it's not great on animal welfare. And we live in a world where people are interested in sustainability and traceability, but also animal welfare. And so taking animals from the top end to Perth or to Melbourne, heaven forbid, you know, is a huge animal welfare issue and just not sustainable in my opinion. So I think it's going to be great for margins, number one, because you won't have that cost. It's going to be great for margins, you're going to have choice as to whether you live trade or whether you slaughter in the top end or not. And I think the other thing is that it opens the door for a more commercial approach to the sort of genetics you're running on the farm, which is what I've just been talking about in Broome to the Kimberley Pilbara Cattle Association.
You mentioned before that there's a possibility that live exports, live cattle exports, may potentially be stopped or impacted in some way over the next few years. So what do you think the role of government is in supporting processing in the top end, if that's the case?
Well, I think that, first of all, the government's position on stopping live exports of cattle is folly and should be, you know, really actively lobbied against. You know, a lot of those cattle are going into countries like Vietnam, like Indonesia, and those countries don't have the cold chain that we've got in this country. In other words, you know, they don't have freezing and cooling and butcher shops with freezing windows and so forth. So the live animal is, you know, needs to be slaughtered in situ and sold into a wet market. So, you know, I think this is just crazy stuff trying to ban that, because that's the reality. And, you know, people forget that that's what we were like 40 years ago as well, by the way. I mean, we can point at these people as though we're holier than thou, but we came from that position. And I think we're better off supporting them with the infrastructure they've got, and also supporting them to extend their cold chains and bring people up that learning curve even quicker. So, but look, let me turn that coin over. The reality is this, that even if the government is hell-bent on stopping that live trade, and I hope they are not, but if they are, then they have a moral responsibility to encourage this processing in the north end of Australia. So no use just taking away a market from somebody and leaving them to take their cattle, you know, 2,000-4,000 kilometres south. That's crazy stuff. I mean, that's that also is animal welfare, which is what they're trying to stop with the live trade. So I think, you know, they've got a moral and ethical and financial responsibility to encourage the processing of animals KMC, south of Broome, and at Livingston, south of Darwin. So, and, you know, I mean, I think Tracy Hayes at NAIF is doing her part in that. They will certainly give moral and financial support to these sorts of opportunities, but the federal government needs to get behind it as well.
How do you think the beef industry here in the north will change in the coming years if these two processing plants do reopen next year in Q3, I think you said?
Well, I think at one level, it won't do anything except be slightly more profitable for them, because you don't have that the extra costs of transporting animals and spelling them and having less than optimal number of buyers. We've got a very strong market at the moment in beef throughout the industry, but we still need to keep these markets open. There's no use just saying, look how good we are at the moment because there's no herd in the US and all that meat's going in at the best price, et cetera, et cetera. We definitely should not be letting our existing customers go, because things will change in the US. In 2 or 3 years, that herd will be back and we'll wonder why we're now not supplying to Vietnam and China and Indo and so forth. So we've got to keep those markets alive. So I think the near-term top end is looking great, obviously, because of the US, but there's also lots of possibilities still in the live trade and elsewhere in the world as well. I think the second thing, though, Jess, that I've been talking to the cattle farmers at Broome about in the last couple of days is, with all of these new younger farmers coming through, we're seeing a lot more innovation, a lot more openness to look at genetics and not to just be relying on Brahmins, but we need some Eurocrosses and other types of cattle on the farm. And to do that, you need to look at your pastures, and you need to look at your feeding programs, and you need to look at transporting animals sometimes to background them to get them closer to processes and feedlots. There's a lot of opportunity there, and I've been encouraging the KPCA and others up there to run some webinars that will go right to the heart of just looking at your farm and, for once, looking at extending the genetics into other species, even as a trial, and on the back of, you know, some more innovative thinking about feeding programs.
David Williams is the Managing Director of Melbourne-based investment bank Kidder Williams, which advises companies on buying and selling businesses, mainly in the agriculture, food and beverages industries. He was speaking to Jess Baker. Processing at AA Co's Livingston Beef facility, which is about 50 kilometres south of Darwin, has been suspended since mid 2018, and Yida's Kimberley Meat Company was the only abattoir in northern WA until it closed in February last year. Yida administrators Corda Mentha has said that the transaction with TLP4 Australian Holdings, which is a subsidiary of Canadian government-owned company Alberta Investment Management Corporation, or AIMCO, was completed on Friday, the 31st of October. 12:15.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
Great to have you along this afternoon. Well, as you would have heard through the course of the day, the Nationals have formally scrapped net zero after a unanimous vote by the party room, minus Barnaby Joyce. An internal review by National Senators Matt Canavan and Senator Ross Cadell concluded a net zero commitment no longer serves the interests of Australian people. The scrapping of the policy has drawn sharp criticism from the government and the Greens, but Nationals Deputy Leader Kevin Hogan says the current path towards net zero is just too expensive.
We're seeing, obviously, you know, everyone's energy bills are going up, power prices are going up. We see, you know, the nickel industry in Western Australia has closed down, and a lot of companies around Australia now, especially big industries, are saying, you know, they can't, they're going to, Tom Ago in New South Wales last week said, look, we're going to close down and we just can't get an energy bill. Now, why do we link net zero with energy prices is, as Australia, we are going faster in cutting emissions than most other countries. As you know, China, India, the US, who are the three biggest emitters in the world, aren't signed up to net zero 2050. So what we've proposed is that we benchmark our emission reductions to OECD countries, take out China and India, because otherwise you could put your emissions up, right? We don't want to do that. But just can do it to OECD countries, like-minded economies, and cut emissions at the same rate as them. So we're not racing ahead and wearing these costs faster than other countries.
And yet you've got organisations like the Business Council of Australia committed to net zero. The Farmers Federation is still committed to net zero. Are you out of step with the business community?
Well, we might be in front of them, but I certainly speak to a lot of businesses privately. I speak to a lot of households as well, who, you know, this affects households, these higher energy prices as well, who understand why we're doing this. The feedback I've had today from, you know, a lot of businesses and farmers as well, is they like the fact that we are committed to climate change action. They like the fact that we are committing to an emission reductions formula that's independent, that is locking us into what other countries are doing. But, you know, they appreciate the fact that, you know, we're not going faster than a whole lot of other countries. And remember, as I said, China, India, US aren't signed up to net zero 2050. It's not that radical with some other countries as well.
But why should we worry about what other countries are doing? Why not worry about what we're doing?
I understand the will of that, but what I'm saying is us going faster than other countries means that our energy bills are going higher than theirs because of that. I'll give you an example. We export a whole lot of energy, like gas, coal, a whole lot of stuff to Japan, and they now have lower energy prices than us, even though we sell that energy to them. And a lot of this is because we are going faster in emission reduction. So we want to do our bit, but we don't want to just export, you know, the industries that are closing down, like the nickel industry, like our aluminium industry. And this is an important sovereign capability that we think we should keep here in Australia, those industries. We don't want to export those jobs because we're cutting emissions faster than other countries. I don't think that's fair to Australia.
Finally, Kevin Hogan, will you get the support of the Liberals? Because your coalition partners now have a different policy position on net zero. So if Susan Lee doesn't go down the path that you have, can you exist as a coalition? Because that's going to be very, very difficult to manage when you're not on the same page.
We've gone into this very, you know, very transparently. I mean, we started this process after the election 6 months ago to get the data, to get the analysis, to do this quite independently and do it evidence-based with getting figures about what's going on. So we've been very transparent about that. I know David Littleproud, our leader, gave a copy of the report well before our announcement yesterday. So she had the heads up about why we're making, you know, what the data is that we'd had behind that. And look, there's very goodwill amongst both parties. They've said, look, get it. We get where you're coming from. We get what, you know, what you're saying here. A lot of Liberals would agree with us, right? They are still, and we respect it, going through their own process where they'll, you know, where they'll sit down and land where they do. I think there'll be a lot of common ground. And if there's grounds where we're not in common, if we don't have the same opinion, that's where we'll have to sit down and try and work something out.
That's Nationals Deputy Leader Kevin Hogan, and he was speaking to Nadia Mitsopoulos. 20 past 12 here on the Country Hour, and I just wanted to let you know that there is a bushfire watch and act. It's in place for some people near Tenindua in the Shire of Chapman Valley in the city of Greater Geraldton. And if you're in that area, search Emergency WA and the warning is at the top. Richard Hudson will give you some more details just after the four-day forecast, just after 12:30 today. Just repeating, a bushfire watch and act in place for some people near Tenindua in the Shire of Chapman Valley in the city of Greater Geraldton. More details just after 12:30. 12:20 here on the Country Hour. And just picking up on the net zero chat, the state Nationals WA parliamentary team and party says it will carefully consider the decisions made by their federal colleagues over the coming days. So we should know the state Nationals position sometime this week in the next couple of days or so. Curious to know, though, is the federal National Party right? Has it made the right decision on net zero or not? The text is 0448. 922604. A lot of texts coming in. I'll get to some of those in just a moment. But while you're thinking about that, Australians are being assured that they'll benefit from lower power prices and a more reliable electricity grid if the federal government sticks by its net zero targets. Australian National University climate professor Frank Yotso says if the Nationals policy was adopted by the federal government, it would be damaging on a number of fronts.
It would undermine investment, right? Much less investment flowing in the electricity sector, a creaking electricity supply system that will lead to higher prices, squandering Australia's advantage as a green energy and green commodity exporter, thereby lower GDP, lower wages. Treasury have actually modelled a scenario something like that in the net zero report. And, that's actually been quantified already what that might mean. I cannot see how this would possibly be to the advantage of the regional areas and agriculture sectors. In fact, quite the opposite.
And what's your response to the argument that, look, Australia only produces 1%, around 1% of global emissions? Why should we do the heavy lifting if other countries are not?
Oh, that's a fallacy. I mean, every nation, large or small, needs to do some of the lifting, and the smart nations design their lifting in a way to maximise national interest while contributing to global climate change solutions. That's what we should be doing, and our national interest here lies in really building up green energy and green commodity export industries to help backfill for the giant hole that will be gaping once international demand for coal and gas falls away. That's what we should be focusing on. We can be a major producer of green iron, of green ammonia, of all sorts of green products, including clean and green agricultural products for exports. And we should be positioning Australia to be known and appreciated as a country that pulls its weight and that is a reliable investment destination for green industries. That's where our future lies, and any hankering for last century's technologies and approaches will only set us back.
Climate Professor Frank Yotso speaking to Radio National's Sally Sara. 12:23, let's get to some of your texts on this matter. Mark in Capel says, the Nationals have hit the nail on the head, common Aussie sense. This from Todd in Albany, at long last, one of the political parties has shown some common sense with regards to net zero. If we continue down that path of net zero, it will break this country. All of this woke, idealistic thinking that we can get rid of gas, etc., and go completely solar and wind is absolute rubbish. The costs are way too big. Australia only accounts for less than 2% of the world emissions, which means we are going to have very little effect. So let's back it up and think about what is actually best for this country. I fully support the Nationals on this, and so should everyone else. Wake up, Australia. You've been conned by Labor, according to Todd. And this too from Ray in Cranbrook. The Nationals have lost the plot. The cost of their decision to scrap net zero will cost them and us more in the long run. The Nats have become the sellout party. This too from Tyson. Stupid question. Anyone who's graduated from kindy should be able to see that net zero will achieve nothing. Bowen and Labor need to get in the real world. The text is 0448 922 604. 12:25. Well, net zero and emissions were also a hot topic at the Kimberley Pilbara Cattlemen's Association annual general meeting in Broome on Friday. Agribusiness consultant Richard Blake told the pastoralists if they hadn't already started tracking their emissions, they really need to get onto it. He says ultimately it will be the market and financial institutions that drive net zero, not the government. And meanwhile, the work on the ground continues. Just over the border in the Northern Territory, a new trial is underway to find ways of breeding cattle that emit less methane. It's a different approach to a lot of recent research that's focused on what to feed livestock to reduce their emissions. Tim Schotts is the head of livestock industries with the NT's Department of Agriculture. He says the idea of this particular project is to identify cattle that burp less than others and then pass that trait onto their offspring.
Yeah, so a grain feed machine, it's a like a little shed that you put out in the paddock. That's a pretty crude way of describing it, but it's all pretty high tech, and the animals will come up to a little bunk, and while they're eating a few loosened pellets to attract them in there, their gases get measured while they're eating it, and it records their NLIS tag. So we've got a record of which animal was in there and for how long, and the methane emissions that it's that we've measured. And then what we'll do there is that we'll, with all the animals that we measure, we'll identify the ones with lower methane emissions, and then we'll look and see if there's a DNA signature there from the DNA samples that we take and send off to the lab. And the ultimate long-term goal is to try and select animals with lower methane emissions, which will be, addressing this issue that faces the industry, where people say that cattle are a cause of or contribute to global warming. So it's sort of a way that we're helping to address that.
So it could be a breeding trait in that if you find animals that seem to emit less methane, that could come up in the genetics and the breeding?
Yeah, exactly. That's wow. The idea is that that it's a heritable thing, and that we'll be able to look for a DNA signature or a gene marker, so to speak, of the animals with the lower emissions. And if we can then select and breed from them, it's a way of breeding cattle with lower methane emissions.
Anyone else doing this?
So we're part of a big Australia-wide collaborative project under the Zero Net Emissions CRC. And there are going to be 25 different sites around Australia where they'll be doing this. And we're actually the first one to kick off here in the Douglas Daily, first one in Australia as part of that. Some of the universities have been using this technology for a while now in their own studies, but this is a major study that we're a part of.
It sounds easier than feeding cattle seaweed.
Certainly in extensive situations, and it's a more permanent thing if you can just breed cattle with lower methane emissions, then probably carting seaweed out to the middle of the NT or the seaweed product is going to be challenging. So this is I guess it's another way. There are a number of different types of additives that are being explored to reduce methane at the moment, but this is another way that we're attacking the problem.
And are you trialling straight Brahmins or some of those composite cattle as well?
We have both. I guess what we're doing is we're using these cattle that we've selected really heavily for fertility over the years. And part of that, we think, the way that they achieve that really good fertility is through maintaining their body condition really well. And if that involves them using feed more efficiently, then perhaps they're have lower methane emissions. So I guess that's something that we will explore and investigate during the course of this work.
Tim Schotts is with the Northern Territory's Department of Agriculture, and he was speaking to Matt Brann. Just on the Nationals dropping the net zero policy, a few more of your thoughts from Wes, who says, such great news from the Nationals over the weekend, and the sooner the ABC and the rest of the woke Australian population wake up to this climate change net zero scam, the better off we will all be. Thanks, Wes. This from Jono. Net zero is a scam and going to cost us greatly. And John says, as a farmer, very vulnerable to climate change, regardless of the cause being 100% proved as human-induced, I believe a precautionary approach is the most secure approach to take. Cigarette smoking and asbestos use were delayed in shutting down for reasons of greed, and it cost millions their lives. Thanks, John. The text 0448 922 604. Half past 12 here on the Country Hour, and Jonathan Hopper is here. He's got the news headlines.
Good afternoon, Belinda. The federal opposition has accused the Optus CEO, Stephen Roux, of sitting on his hands during September's 000 outage that is linked to three deaths. A Senate inquiry into the outage has heard it took Optus 17 hours to inform the Australian Communications and Media Authority that people had died. UK investigators are trying to establish the motive of the lone suspect in a stabbing attack on a London-bound train. Several people are still in hospital, with one person in a life-threatening condition. A 32-year-old British man is being held on suspicion of attempted murder. And the West Coast Eagles say they're confident heading into their first ever AFLW final. The Eagles finished the season in eighth and will head to Melbourne later this week to face Carlton in an elimination final. It'll be a rematch of last Friday night's game between the sides, which the Blues won by 20 points. Thanks, Belinda.
Thank you so much for the update, Jonathan. 29-1.
You're with Belinda Varaschetti on the Country Hour on ABC Local Radio, WA.
Great to have you along. Between now and the news at 1, we'll head off to Mouche just before the news at 1, get the results of the cattle market, take a look at the yarding and also the prices. And then we'll also take a look at the Bureau of Meteorology's new website. Was launched, was it last week? No, the week before. And there's been a lot of feedback about the new website. And as a result of that, there have already been some changes made to the new website. So we'll look at that. They sort of kicked off making some changes around the colour of the radar for you. I wonder if you've taken a look at that since those changes came into effect on Friday. I think they made a few tweaks here and there. So let me know what you think if you've had a chance to go and have a play around with it now that there's been a few changes to the new site. Let me know. 0448 922 604. We'll take a look at that shortly. First, let's make our way to the Bureau of Meteorology. And Angeline Prasad is with you this afternoon. And, gee, it's another sort of mixed bag this week, isn't it? I mean, fine conditions across most of the Southwest Land Division today, but a little bit of rain on the way this week too.
Good afternoon, Belle. Yes, you're absolutely correct. So we've got a firm ridge of high pressure across southern WA today, and that's combining with a developing west coast trough to bring in some really warm conditions to the northern parts of the Southwest Land Division this afternoon. So temperatures, daytime temperatures are going to get above 30 degrees across the central west, parts of the central wheat belt and the lower west, and hot and dry and windy conditions are driving some elevated fire dangers. So we do also have a fire weather warning out for the Midwest Coast and the Central West. But as you've mentioned, there's a bit of a change tomorrow. So as that West Coast trough moves offshore, we'll see a low pressure system develop within the West Coast trough. And tomorrow, both these systems deepen offshore, and it'll connect to some tropical moisture in the north. So that whole system drags in or provides a tropical infeed of moisture into southern WA. So tomorrow we'll see showers and thunderstorms develop across the Gascoyne, the Southwest Land Division and the Goldfields. And it's possible we may see some risk of severe thunderstorms as well, especially through eastern parts of the central wheat belt, southeast Gascoyne, and extending maybe into the adjacent goldfields area. So there is a possibility we may see some heavy falls with those thunderstorms. The trough and the low pressure system move over land on Wednesday, so move across the west coast and continue to bring widespread showers and thunderstorms. So it will feel quite windy, stormy, and wet as well, especially on Wednesday. So a very broad area of showers and thunderstorms right across southern and central WA. And again, that risk of severe thunderstorms will still remain on Thursday, extending through much of the central wheat belt, the Great Southern, and also through much of the goldfields into the interior, including the southeastern parts of the Gascoyne. So how much rain are we going to get with these with the evolving weather pattern? So today, obviously, it's quite dry, but we might see one or two dry thunderstorms develop across parts of the central west and western parts of the Gascoyne, so not much rainfall. Maybe up to a millimeter if these thunderstorms do eventuate, and most likely in the late afternoon to the overnight period. Tomorrow, as the system evolves and we see that ridge weaken over southern WA, we could potentially see 5 to 10 millimeters and sort of through the northern parts of the southwest land division, through the southern parts of central west, much of the central wheat belt, Great Southern, lower west and southwest, and falls. If we do see those thunderstorms develop, falls could get up to 10 to 20 millimeters. And it is also possible that if we see a bit of training in the thunderstorms, falls could get up to 20 to 40 millimeters. So there is that risk of heavy falls. On Wednesday, we will see these widespread moderate falls continue, so widespread 5 to 10 millimeters. But areas through eastern parts of the central wheat belt, east of Maradon, much of the goldfields, and also parts of the Great Southern into the southwest could see another 10 to 20 millimeters. But if we do see those severe thunderstorms, it could get up to 20 to 40 millimeters. Now, on Wednesday, the severe thunderstorms I have mentioned, apart from having the chance of heavy falls, there could also be a risk of damaging winds and also hail. So it does become a bit worse. The weather does become quite a bit worse on Wednesday. And then on Thursday and Friday, we do have an easing trend as the whole system moves further east into the interior. So there will still be showers lingering on Thursday, but yeah, we do see a bit of an easing pattern as a new ridge moves in. So a bit of a mixed bag, yes, over the next few days across the southwest.
And then what does all that mean for northern and eastern parts of the state, Ange?
Well, the two systems will bring showers and thunderstorms to the Gascoyne and the Goldfields, the Eucla and the Southern Interior, but also to inland parts of the Pilbara over the next couple of days. Not today, but certainly tomorrow and into Wednesday. And then we'll see the clearing trend across these areas on Thursday and Friday. Across the north, we have seen sort of across the Kimberley and interior, we did see quite a bit of thunderstorm activity over the weekend. Over the next couple of days, thunderstorms do become a bit more isolated across the Kimberley, sort of more so across and contracting to the northern parts of the Kimberley. But yes, still quite hot and humid across the north, so that pattern is not likely to change. But maybe a bit of an easing trend in the thunderstorms over the next couple of days before thunderstorms become a bit more extensive from Friday onwards across the Kimberley.
Ange, thank you for all those details. Appreciate that. 22 to 1, Richard Hudson is here now. He's got the rainfall details for you.
Yeah, so 9 o'clock on Friday morning through to 9 o'clock this morning. In the northern and eastern forecast districts, the only region to get any rain was the Kimberley, and it'll be 10 and above. So Drysdale River Station, 28, Gibb River, 21, Marion Downs, 10, Mount Barnett, 20, Mount House, 35, Nicholson, 10, Parry Creek Farm, 13, Winjana Gorge, 39, and Wyndham recorded 49. Then in the southwest land division and the central west, there was nothing over 2 mils. In the lower west, a fair bit more, so it'll be 10 and above. Bungendore 15, Dwelling Up 14, Glen Eagle 10, Jarrodale 22, Carnot 13, Carrigulla North 17, Pinjarra South 10 and Serpentine 13. In the southwest, there was a similar amount of rain, so it's 10 and above there as well. Acton Park 15, Bridgetown 14, Brunswick Junction 18, Busselton Shire recorded 10, Carlotta 31, Chapman Hill 20, Collie 11, Dardanup 15, Donnybrook 10, Doyle Road 13, Ferguson Valley 14, Happy Valley Alert Station 13, Harvey 12, Hentybrook 14, Jarrowood is 16, Logbrook 19, Manjimup 22, Ludlow 11, Mount William 17, Myalup 11, Nanup 16, Northcliffe 13, Perivale Orchard 10, Quinnanup 12, Rosabrook 11, Shannon 12, Vass 11, Willyabrup 13, Yanmar 17 and Yungarillup recorded 13. Then in the southern coastal region, it's 10 and above there as well. Albany 12, Denmark 14, Kimberley 11, King River 14, Many Peaks 10, Mount Barker 11, Narracup West 13 and Stirlings North 10 and Tamar recorded 12. And then in the central wheat belt, there was nothing above 3 mils that Mount Westdale got. And in the Great Southern, most locations seem to get between 1 and 9. Above that, Chaming Up recorded 12. Franklin also had 12 and Tunney 11. So, yeah, there is a bit of a fire that's causing a bit of concern just east of Geraldton. So roughly 60 k's east of Geraldton. It's a bushfire watch and act now, and that's in place for some people in that shire of Chapman Valley in the city of Greater Geraldton. So it's for people in the Ambania, North Erridu and Tininjua areas. And so that's an area bounded by Geraldton, Mount Magnet Road, Desmond Road, Una Tininjua Road, Burton Williamson Road and Valentine Road. And DFIS is saying there is a possible threat to lives and homes in that area as the fire is burning and conditions are changing. If your plan is to leave, make sure you leave now. That fire was only first reported at 9:30 this morning, and so it's obviously causing some concerns. It's now moving in a southwesterly direction, in other words, towards Geraldton. It's not contained or controlled, and fire response units, heavy machinery and a bushfire brigade volunteer firefighters are on their way. If you want more detailed information, just go to Emergency and WA, and the warning is at the top of the website. And if you're going to the Emergency WA app, just go to the warnings and it's the one at the top, and just make sure you keep listening to ABC local radio. So just repeating, a bushfire watch and act is in place for a fire that is burning about 60 k's east of Geraldton right now.
Thanks for that, Richard. 19 to 1 here on the Country Hour. The Bureau of Meteorology has made some changes to the colour of the radar and flagged that more changes are on the way as the backlash continues over its new website. While the Bureau fine-tunes the new site, many users have turned to the old legacy website, that's the reg.bomb.gov.au site. But how much longer it's going to remain active is unclear. General Manager of Environment and Prediction Services at the Bureau is Matt Colopy, and he says priority adjustments were made to the radar on Friday.
The key change was really to move the default. So you could already on the display on the new website find the radar reflectivity, often referred to as the DBZ. But the default was actually set to what you call the rainfall rate in millimetres per hour, which was what is on our app at the moment. So we had that common sort of display between the app and the new website. But after a lot of community feedback and people being familiar with the display that is reflectivity, we actually changed that default. So you could already find it there, but we changed the default.
So the colour rate was what changed, but you've gone from one setting to the other.
The display is slightly different. So the colours are fairly similar, and you can see the sort of legend there that tells you from sort of light rain through to moderate and heavy rain. The difference is in a rainfall rate, millimetres per hour, it on occasions won't pick up the really intense reflectivity echo. So for example, if you've got hail in a massive thunderstorm, that hail will spike really strong reflectivity values, and it'll show those colours in that red or even black end of that sort of really strong reflectivity. Now, of course, if it's hailing, is really significant for severe weather, but it doesn't actually show up as rainfall because it is literally hail and solid water. So it's a slightly different way of looking at the radar, but the community feedback was really strong on that people wanted to see that reflectivity or that DBZ scale and display, so we changed that back.
So is this latest change, and there's been a few others in terms of what you can see when you, get onto the main website and where the links are, etc. Is it an admission that things weren't right, that some of these changes were mishandled by the Bureau?
I think you've seen over the past 18 months or so, 15 months in fact, we've had a beta available in the public domain so people can test it. We've had sort of initial focus groups of over 2,000 people doing that testing. And then as it was in beta, we had over 700 different specific sort of users that were giving us feedback. But the reality is you take all that in, you've got it online for people to look at in advance. But as you go public and you see 2 million people looking at that site, every day, you're always going to get additional feedback, and we're basically responding to that. So yes, it is an admission that we've got additional feedback now as it's gone public, as it's gone live, and we're responding.
Other changes expected to happen to this website now? Obviously, you've made this change here on the radar. There's been an enormous amount of feedback over a multiple amounts of different parts of that website. So is more expected here?
I think the key is there are certain specific feedback points, like how we display locations and the map itself and so on. And some of the things like seeing the radar kind of coverage map, which I think people gave. So those specific feedback points are certainly things that we can incorporate into the sort of future releases as we continue to upgrade and update the website. And then there are other things where we just need to really explain and work, probably do a better job of working through and explaining the different navigation features and the advantages and the differences between the old website and the new website.
Criticisms we've been getting quite extensively, the radar information becoming more vague, a lot of the data being washed out of the site, one example being fire danger ratings. Now, you still have the high, moderate and extreme, but the actual number used to be displayed next to that so people could to delve into just how bad that fire danger rating is. That's not there anymore. And other stuff, as you've just alluded to, being hard to find. So in terms of that scale of feedback, are some things going to be looked at and others just being thought of as the public needs to learn?
I think just addressing the fire danger behaviour index up front, that one is going to be changed. So we are looking and working with the emergency management authorities, the fire authorities, CFA, to actually update that, not just for Victoria, but for the country. So that one, that specific one, will be addressed. And in terms of, again, just working through and saying, well, there's some things that have changed and the data's still there, but it's just displayed differently. So that will take time to get used to, and we do need to do a better job of really explaining that. And I think a lot of our sort of YouTube and other video and Facebook releases are working through some of that.
What about making it easier just to see multi-day views of forecasts where it used to be on one page for a region or a town, and now you've got to click through? Are considerations being made there?
That is a really good one, because some of the feedback and when we got where the design was, people just, they really look interested in their location. So that's why when you come into the page, it says, where do you want to see information for? And you put in Ararat, and Ararat brings up all the information for your area, and you work through that. But I understand that people in some cases wanted to look at a whole bunch of towns across Victoria. That is something we'll have to consider and understand how we can best display that in a sort of accessible and logical way.
General Manager of Environment and Prediction Services at the Bureau of Meteorology, Matt Colopy, speaking to Warwick Long. And he does say at this stage there is no set date to turn off the old legacy website, which is reg.bom.gov.au. So that's sticking around for a little while longer by the sounds of things. 12 minutes to one. Just on the new website, Floyd in Northam says the site is flickering and something horribly wrong with the site. And this from Philip in Kojanup, who says, I think the new bomb site is a disaster. To patronisingly tell people that the new system is an improvement when it obviously isn't, and when presented with negative feedback, suggests we just need to learn how to use it, illustrates a complete bloody-mindedness. They won't change it willingly. They must be forced to. Text through, let me know what you're thinking. 0448 922 604. Western rock lobster fishers are contributing to an international ocean monitoring project which is gathering data to better understand what happens beneath the ocean surface. 10 boats fishing from Mandurah to Kalbarri have sensors attached to some pots that of gathering data on depth and water temperature. Western Rock Lobster Council CEO Matt Taylor says they're happy to help because any increase in knowledge and data helps fisheries become more resilient.
We have a lot of information around the surface physical parameters, sea surface levels and salinity, that sort of thing, for tracking the Leeuwin current down the coast. But what we don't know is what's actually happening at the pot on the bottom of the ocean, and we want to know whether different parameters affect the catchability of rock lobster, but also understand the relationship between what's happening at the bottom of the ocean compared to what's being recorded on the surface.
So how do you go about measuring that? What is it that you're putting on some of these pots?
Yeah, so we started with two boats that piloted this subsea data collection, and we've been working with FishSoup, which is Indian Ocean Marine Observation System and part of UWA as well, but also a national network of data collection. So we've been partnering with them to have a box that sits on the boat and then a sensor in each pot, and we've got 8 different sensors for these two boats. So we've currently got 16 sensors in the fishery, and that tracks the temperature and the depth of the water for each pot drop, and then while the pot's on the bottom of the ocean, and then also for the pot pull. So we get 2 water column profiles, as well as what's happening at a pot level for the duration that pot's on the bottom. And it's been successful so far in this pilot of 2 boats with 8 sensors each, that we're now just approved the expansion of that. So we'll add an additional 8 boats, and also with 4 sensors for each boat, because at the moment we're just sampling the waters out from Mandra and from Geraldton, but we also want to know what's happening throughout the fishery. So we've selected boats that fish at different locations throughout the fishery, and we'll now get a better profile from sort of Kalbarri down to Mandra about what's happening in the water column, and also what's happening at the pot level on the bottom of the ocean. So at the moment they're just recording temperature and depth, which is a good start, but we would also like to in the future incorporate things like dissolved oxygen, turbidity, what's happening with pH, the salinity. But unfortunately at the moment the sensors for those sorts of parameters are very expensive,
yeah.
And cost prohibitive, really.
If you can get that more specific information, does that then give you information on reproduction, ideal environments, that sort of thing? Is that where you're going, trying to get that information?
Yeah, exactly. And also climate change. We're trying to understand how the climate is affecting our fishery or the waters in our fishery, but that would also benefit octopus fisheries, other fisheries on the west coast of Western Australia. So, yeah, we're just trying to get a better feel for how climate is affecting our fishery, but also at a catch level, what is affecting the catchability of rock lobsters? Does dissolved oxygen affect them? Does pH affect them? Because we have swirling eddies of water with the Leeuwin current that come down the coast, and we know what's happening at a surface level. We don't know what's happening at a benthic level or the bottom of the ocean, and we want to better understand that so that we can better manage the fishery into the future.
Western Rock Lobster Council CEO Matt Taylor speaking to Joe Prendergast. And if you want to learn more about the Fish Soup program that lobster fishery is participating in, it's online. You can read about it. Just search ABC Rural and Fishing and you'll find Joe's story along with other fishing stories. 8:01. Well, a new type of software has been developed which allows mining companies to monitor what's said over two-way radios on site. It's designed to speed up the time it takes to address hazards or issues, picking up on key words like pothole or dust. New South Wales-based mining consultant Jason Knights thinks the technology is a good example of how artificial intelligence can improve communication across mine sites.
Look, it can listen to radio waves using voice recognition, and then through machine learning, it can pick up keywords that operators of mining equipment use when they make radio transmissions. And often these keywords can help paint a picture of what's happening at a mining operation. And since there's so many radio channels at a mining operation, not everyone can be listening to every channel all the time and hear this information. So this software is able to do this in the background, pick up these keywords and then highlight these to the relevant people that there's certain things occurring across that operation.
So can you give an example of the sorts of keywords it might be looking out for, I suppose?
Look, it's anything to do with something that is abnormal to the operation. So it could be to do with excessive dust on a haul road. It could be due to the condition of the haul road. There could be potholes somewhere that, you know, are affecting a large piece of mining equipment. It could even be that, you know, one end of the operation is getting heavy rainfall where the other end is dry. So operators talk about this, and it just helps people on the mine site who aren't always listening to be able to have these keywords picked up automatically, know that there's a system in the background doing this, and then highlight those keywords and those conditions that are occurring in real time to them on a mobile device, on a dashboard somewhere.
Okay, so that's how it works. It sort of will send you some sort of notification if you're the supervisor or something.
Yeah, it can. And especially if multiple operators or multiple people are using similar words, it can really point out that, hey, there's an issue over here, or there's something emerging over here. And given most mining equipment uses GPS, those radio transmissions are always geolocated as well. So now it can tag where the transmissions are being made in terms of a position in the mining operation and help understand what is going on. So it's just a way of having a little bit more information and intelligence on what's happening around the operation without the need for someone to sit there and monitor many radio channels.
It is an interesting concept. Is the software being used by any mining companies in Australia or you know, overseas from what you're aware of?
I don't believe it's being used in Australia. It's only very, very new on the market, and I'm talking literally the last month. It's developed by someone who's been playing around with AI and voice recognition and machine learning for a couple of years to come up with this. They saw a niche in the market, so it's really only just hit the market, but I can definitely see a benefit in it for mining operations in Australia and around the world.
And so this added layer of monitoring, I guess, listening to people's chatter on two ways, do you think it's an invasion of privacy?
No, look, most mining operations, when you sign the contract or you sign your agreement, your employment agreement, there's always a clause in there that, you know, there is cameras on sites and two-way radio traffic is already recorded. Most states require it to be recorded under legislation for investigation purposes. So at the moment, I don't see that adding an extra layer on top of that. It's just part and parcel of it.
And how good is it at sort of differentiating between accents or words that might sound the same? Like, are there errors often?
Look, it can be early on, and that's where training these models, and that's why machine learning is important. Machine learning is all about training models and introducing different accents, different phrases, different words, and teaching it to learn is how you get these things to improve, and that takes time. So I imagine this company's used a range of radio recordings, and as we know, two-way radio isn't the best at the best of times in terms of clarity. So I imagine they've used a library of radio recordings to try and make this as good as possible, and will continue to do that as they get customers.
Mining consultant Jason Knight speaking to Georgia Hargreaves about a new type of technology that uses AI and voice recognition to monitor the chat on two-way radios. It's called Canary Waves, and the tech's so new, it actually isn't being used in Australia just yet. But Jason doesn't think it's going to be too long before this AI tech does get embraced and used widespread across mine sites. 3 minutes to one to the market now. Almost 1,500 head of cattle sold at the Mouchay sale yards this morning, and Terry Birkin has all the details for you.
Hi, Belinda. Today's sale was very similar to last week, both in volume and very mixed, from plain light partial cars up to good runs of finished trade weights for processing. The buying field was attended by most regulars as well as several seasonal restockers, keeping values on most weaners and yearlings equal on recent gains. The cow market was a little softer today, while heavy bulls gained 10 to 15 cents and shipping bulls lifted 30 to 40 cents a kilo. Local weaner steers were selling from 340 to 452 cents, while weaner heifers were making 200 to 380 cents a kilo. Local yearling steers under 330 kg sold from 350 to 404 cents and heavier weights from 300 to 460 cents a kilo. Yearling heifers under 330 kg were selling from 220 to 340 cents and with more weight and frame returned 336 cents to 402 cents a kilo. Light frame pastoral steer cars started from 124 cents and with bigger steers in frame and condition sold up to 402 cents, while plain pastoral heifers started from 70 cents up to 372 cents for better heifers. Local grain steers returned 250 cents to 422 cents, while pastoral steers sold from 340 to 364 cents a kilo. Local grain heifers returned 260 to 384 cents, and pastoral heifers were showing very good finish, ranging from 100 cents to 374 cents a kilo. Light frame pastoral store cows sold from 80 cents to 170 cents, while bigger frame stores were selling from 180 to 270 cents a kilo. Medium weight cows returned 250 to 282 cents, and heavy cows sold to a top of 314 cents, easing 10 to 15 cents a kilo. Plain bulls back to paddock sold from 150 to 280 cents, while bulls suited for shipping lifted 30 to 40 cents, making 240 to 410 cents. And heavy bulls gained another 10 cents, ranging from 220 to 330 cents a kilo. This is Terry Birkin for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Terry, thank you so much for going through those details today. We'll be back at Mouchet again tomorrow for the results of the sheep market. News time now, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.